Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
How are things your end?
Well, it's pretty hard times, isn't it? I mean, for the country and, you know, very strange times.
How are you finding being a teacher to your two lads?
I'm trying to do my bit. I think my wife is not for the first time doing better than me, but I'm trying to sort of share the load. And she had this idea that I should teach them how to do a speech.
How's that gone for you?
Not a speech about sort of post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory or something, but something that they are interested in. Well, Sam is going to do the Liverpool-Barcelona semi-final when Liverpool came back. That was last year. And Daniel's doing chess.
Nice.
And I said the beginning of the speech has to sort of grab people by the ghoulies. They were quite surprised that I would say that.
I think we're all quite surprised that you used the word ghoulies in 2020.
Well, you're not surprised, are you, really?
Well, no, it's very, very on brand for you to be using a word that we haven't heard since the 80s.
Anyway, it's a way to distract them. How are you coping?
Yeah, you know, sort of the same. I'm trying to figure out how to fill the time with my four-year-old. We're doing lots of drawing.
I'll tell you what I'd really recommend. There's this cartoonist or illustrator called Rob Biddulph. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's been doing this thing online about how to draw. And you basically, he draws it online, whatever, and then you sort of, you know, emulate him. And I got really into it. I was helping Sam colour in. I mean, I'm sort of don't think of myself as very good at drawing at all, but there was something very satisfying about doing that with him. Just for people to know, it's called hashtag draw with Rob, and you can find it online. And he's done a Gregosaurus, a sausage dog, Fred Bear, and Kevin.
He's like a Tony Hart for the new millennium.
Shall I say what we're talking about this week?
Yes.
This week we're talking about supporting children and young people through the current crisis. This is obviously an incredibly difficult time for everyone, but we're asking how we can support children's mental health and well-being during this period of uncertainty and anxiety. The schools are obviously closed, except for a small number of children. And I think we're all learning what an incredible job schools do, or being reminded of what an incredible job schools do. We know that school closures risk widening the achievement gap between wealthier and less wealthy children based on the resources they have at home. We know all children and families are facing pressure. We're going to be asking educational psychologist Dan O'Hare about how to talk to children about coronavirus and support them when out of school. Then we'll be talking to Jane Kennedy, the head teacher of Barlow Hall Primary School in Manchester, and this is an inspiring conversation, one of many schools doing amazing work with pupils and families during the current crisis. And then we're talking to Becky Francis from the Education Endowment Foundation about how to minimise the impact of school closures on educational inequality.
and our cheerful people this week. We've spoken to one of them before. It's Alex Smith, who is the chief executive of the Cares family, and he's going to be joining us along with one of his volunteers, Amy Harvey, to talk about how they're connecting with older neighbours during this period of social distancing.
What's your reason to be cheerful, Jeff?
Well, in amongst all this, something beautiful has happened to me. So I went to my kitchen drawer, the utensil drawer, the other night and tried to open it, and it would not open. Something's jammed in there. I am not somebody who's very practical at all in this situation. I would probably shake it a few times and then, you know, get someone in the next day to come round and fix it. And obviously, I can't do that with social distancing. So I put a video of it up on Twitter, and it's had around 70,000 views at the point at which we're talking to each other. And I'm being inundated with suggestions from people about how I can unblock my utensil drawer. And it's a beautiful thing. I'm providing regular updates. I've tried many different things. Nothing is working at the moment. Most of the suggestions now are involving brute force, which I don't have very much of. But it's just incredible how much the Twitter community has rallied around me at this difficult time of not being able to open my kitchen drawer.
I mean, I've got to say the Twitter community has really come into its own, hasn't it?
Mm.
I've spent a period off Twitter for about 3 months from Christmas, and then the virus has sort of forced me back onto it just because, well, it just has. I mean, obviously your drawer has been fantastic, but I mean, I think I've been sending you and my wife some of the, not in that order, my wife and you, some of the sort of highlights. I mean, my particular favourite, this wasn't going to be my reason to be cheerful, but it is one, is the woman and the man who pretended to be a horse.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's so good.
I mean, it's really hard to describe, but she's got very long hair and she pretends to be the back of a horse. And then he is the sort of front of the horse, and it is honestly just, I mean, I thought it had like 9 million views when I'd watched it. Yeah. I mean, not that I'm making your views feel sort of inadequate, but, you know, but I think your draw thing is brilliant.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, look, mine is sort of slightly, it doesn't feel like it compares to your draw, but well, one of the challenges when you're not watching the telly is how you can make sure you're not actually listening to more and more stuff about coronavirus, because the psychologists are rightly saying you've got to limit your exposure to the news. And I just listened to an absolutely, honestly, and I don't tend to get emotional, as you know, about these kind of things, but I found myself incredibly emotional about this episode of The Daily about Tom Hanks. And basically, it's this episode of The Daily where this New York Times reporter goes to interview Tom Hanks, and she's having a really hard time. And then halfway through the interview, or even less, she basically sort of bursts into tears in front of Tom Hanks in this interview. And it's all about what a nice man Tom Hanks is.
I'll listen to that. That sounds great.
It was on the 15th of March. It's a special episode. The Tom Hanks story will make you feel less bad. And it certainly made me feel less bad.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So to talk to us about the emotional and psychological effect on children, we have Dan O'Hare, who is an educational psychologist in Gloucestershire and lecturer at the University of Bristol. Dan, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. I mean, I'm quite concerned. I've got a four-year-old. Ed's got boys who are a bit older than that. And I'm sort of worried about whether I'm doing a good job communicating to him. So what I'm trying to explain is everything's closed at the moment. We can't go to the playground. We can't, you know, go to the cafe because people are poorly and we could make them more poorly if we go outside. So we've all got to give each other space. How good a job do you think I'm doing for a four-year-old?
I think firstly, like, being worried is absolutely normal as a parent. You know, having that worry is normal. Lots of parents are going through that, and just that sense of what do I say, how do I say it, what words do I use. And it's particularly difficult, like, if you've got children of different ages. But the fact that, you know, what you said is that you're saying to them that, you know, we can't go to the park, you know, people are ill, you know, if we're near them we might make them worse. What we as educational psychologists have said is being truthful is really important. And the fact that you're saying what I'm doing is being truthful is a really good thing to be doing. Because children just seem to know, don't they? They kind of know when we're not being truthful. And I just wonder if sometimes that leads to those thoughts around, well, what's missing here? What am I missing? And there's that risk, isn't there? If we're not truthful and factual with children, that they might have gaps in their understanding. And if those gaps are there, children have that sort of capacity to, as do adults actually, fill those gaps with their imagination.
How bad can that fill in those gaps be? So my son, when he was still at nursery, when the nursery was still open, was talking. He started talking a lot about germs. And then I started spinning my wheels thinking, what if he now grows up germ phobic? Because, you know, they're getting sort of half of bits of information.
The difficulty is that there's lots of media at the moment, isn't there? Whether it be social media, TV, and children can be seeing things that might seem really different and really scary. But empathizing in that moment with a child can be really powerful. So when children are saying things like that and sort of possibly, you know, starting to talk about germs, what they might be doing is actually just expressing to us their anxiety about what they're witnessing. And we as adults have that kind of responsibility to help children label what they're feeling. So if they're asking questions about germs or about diseases, we can sort of reflect back to them, can't we? You know, yeah, all this talk about germs is kind of worrying sometimes, isn't it? And even that act of just labeling that emotion of worry can really reduce the intensity of that emotion for a child or young person.
And how about them picking up stuff from the news? So I know it's a different situation, but I feel like I'm part of a generation who grew up with anxiety because you'd be seeing stuff about the nuclear bomb on the news the whole time. I mean, is this going to filter through? Are we going to have a sort of inevitable generation of anxious people because of what they're experiencing through the news during coronavirus?
I'm not sure if it's inevitable. I think part of our role as adults is to kind of filter all of that news media. So, you know, whether it's joint viewing a news program with a young person, whether it's making sure that actually as adults, we kind of restrict the amount of time that we're spending on news media so that we can then give the really key information to children rather than them having just sort of unfiltered access to it. Because children's understanding will differ depending on their age or the maturity. And, you know, parents and carers are going to know that better than anyone. So we can sort of do that for children, just filter it.
And do we need to be managing our own anxiety under normal circumstances? If you're an anxious parent, then you can pass that anxiety on to children. Do we need to be working hard to sort of manage our own anxieties around the coronavirus?
Yeah, definitely. When you go on a plane, you know, they give you that message, don't they? If something happens, put your own mask on first before you help someone else. And I think that analogy is really powerful for emotions as well. So if we're feeling really anxious or uncertain or perhaps frustrated, and we try and have a conversation with a child about their frustrations or their anxieties, then they're likely to sort of feed off each other. We might not be in the right position to have that conversation. So it is really important for adults to kind of recognize how they're feeling in that moment. And if you're feeling anxious or panicked, perhaps you've just had a work email that's panicked you, or you've seen something on the news about a different city that, you know, you might have family members there, it's going to be really important for us to kind of identify and recognize, well, what helps me feel calmer before I talk about this to my child or young person? What can I do to sort of bring my own emotions down? Do I need to listen to music? Do I need to go to the garden if you're lucky enough to have one? Can I just spend 10 minutes with the cat? You know, something that reduces adult anxiety is going to help children, because that's reassuring in itself, isn't it? If we're feeling sort of calmer and more relaxed.
Now, Dan, you've talked about how we should talk to our kids about this issue and how we should deal with it. What about the more general advice you would give about the experience we should be looking for kids to have during this time, and the balance between schoolwork, screen time, having a nice time?
Yeah.
give us your thinking.
The first thing is that it's uncertain for everyone. As educational psychologists, alongside everyone else, we haven't experienced anything like this before either. And it's really hard to try and give good advice while recognizing that the situation is changing all the time. But it can be really tempting, I think, you know, particularly as schools have closed, it can be really tempting to focus on their educational activities, learning, online learning, all those sorts of things. But I think the first piece of advice for parents and carers is that don't try to replicate a full school timetable at home. Homes aren't set up to be schools. Most parents aren't teachers. And it's what do children need at this moment in time? Well, lots of children might be feeling uncertain. They'll be experiencing kind of extended social isolation away from their friends. They might not have seen family members that they're used to seeing. And so they probably don't right now need the stress of learning how to learn at home, you know, trying to log on and handle all the online learning systems. The things that would be really powerful are play. Number one, play is fundamental to children's well-being and development. So trying to play as much as you can. And there's a lot of learning in play as well. You know, if you play shops, you're learning about social interaction, you're learning about communication, you're learning about money, you're learning about weight, you know, all of those different things, even in a game of sort of playing shops. So play is really important. And it's okay to, you know, if a young person wants to do maths or wants to do some online learning, that's fantastic. But it's kind of okay as a parent or a carer to recognize that might not happen today, and that's fine. You know, perhaps we're just in a position today to read some books and play with Lego. That's absolutely fine. And giving ourselves permission for that flexibility can be calming and reassuring for the child, but also for us as adults.
I suppose, speaking about the experience of my own kids during the last week of being at home, I'm quite struck that I think as a parent, one's ambitions go, you sort of have a change of priorities from they need to learn while they're away from school to we need to get through this and they need to have as okay an experience as it can be. Because I suppose I feel like you want to reduce the trauma of this event as much as possible.
Definitely.
And if it's a miserable time, then that's going to make it a more negative experience.
I absolutely agree, Ed, in terms of what are children going to look back and remember? They're going to look back and remember the chance to play, play board games, watch TV programs, you know, all the stuff. If you do have internet access, you know, I'm seeing fantastic videos of parents getting involved with some of this YouTube PE lessons in the mornings, and they look like they're having such great fun. The only other thing I was going to talk about was there's been lots of focus, and I think you do see it on social media a lot. There's been lots of focus on a routine. And I think there are different levels of routine. So some conversations have been focusing on the routine of sort of actual lessons throughout the day. So perhaps, you know, some English in the morning and then some numeracy or, you know, some science. And it kind of feels like perhaps the routines that are maybe more important to focus on are the routines of good sleep, you know, good bedtimes, you know, keeping meal times at the same time, making sure that you really capitalize on that exercise opportunity, you know, for a walk to the park or a walk around the block, and making sure that all of those really important routines of sleep, exercise and diet, they kind of feel like the more important ones at the moment than thinking about actual school lessons, because they're the things that are really important to our physical but also our mental health as well.
For those of us who do have very young children, how concerned should we be about the developmental impact on having their ability to socialise with other children completely removed?
I suppose, in a sense, you know, when things get back to normal and schools are back in place in early years settings, you know, there's a sense of most children will have been in the same situation. And I suppose it's, you know, schools are going to be totally aware of that. And you can imagine that at the time they're going to be focusing on how to support children back into school settings or earlier settings. But, you know, the richness of interaction that can come from playing with parents and carers, you know, that can come from FaceTiming or Skyping or WhatsApping friends. My colleague and my colleague's friend both have children. I think they're around 2 years old. And she had sent a WhatsApp video of her son to another parent because their sons are very good friends. And the parent came back and just said that, you know, the other child absolutely loved that video and got so much from it. But that he didn't really understand yet, you know, at two and a half, why he couldn't play with this other child. But there's so many things we can do in terms of, as I say, that play, doing things together, supporting as far as possible some of that contact with other children. So whether that be through FaceTime or Skype or Zoom or whatever it is. And just some of the things you see in local communities, right? You know, sort of walking around my area, there's so many of those rainbows on people's windows. And I just wonder, you know, if you're a child and you've done that, you've put a rainbow on your window and you go for your daily walk, perhaps with your mum or dad or carer, and you see other rainbows on windows, that sense of belonging and connection and being part of something bigger, that's going to be so rewarding. And trying to sort of encourage those sorts of expressions of community and of belonging, they're kind of what would be called protective factors for children.
Where should people go if they want support? Are there particular websites you'd recommend around some of the issues we've been talking about, particularly how to handle, you know, some of the difficult things their kids may be thinking about and talking about?
Yeah, so the British Psychological Society, last week we published two pieces of guidance specifically for parents and schools. So our first piece of guidance is talking to children about coronavirus, and our second piece is around supporting schools and parents and carers because of the school closures. But there's also some fantastic resources on the Young Minds website, for example. So they kind of thinking about the general situation, but also young people who might be experiencing some of the negative effects of social isolation. And it's kind of an issue of what should we leave out if we're recommending places to go, because so many different organizations are really stepping up. So there's an organization called Winston's Wish, for example, and their webpages are fantastic in terms of, you know, if a child has experienced a bereavement because of the virus, or if they are living with or witnessing someone who's experiencing severe illness. Winston's Wish is a great organisation to get information from for that side of things.
Okay, Dan O'Hare, stay safe. Thank you very much
for
joining us. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
We're going to talk now to Jane Kennedy, who is the head teacher of Barlow Hall Primary School in Manchester. Jane, thanks for coming on talking to us. It must be an incredibly strange time for you. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about how the last few weeks building up to this have been, what kind of plans you had in place, and how the teachers and pupils at your school have been dealing with it?
It's been an incredibly strange time over the last few weeks. I think the build-up, as you said, has been quite a few weeks. I don't like being a virtual head, I'll be honest with you. It's very strange. It's just been so fast, everything, for everybody. It's the same for all of us, really. It's been so fast. I think it's quite difficult to plan for things when you know that what was important in the morning is different by the afternoon. The great thing, though, is that I think across schools, certainly the schools that I'm close to, I've been working incredibly hard, pulling together and knowing that they're really, really committed to make the difference, really.
And what was the sort of frame of mind like of the pupils in the run-up to it? So what you're dealing with kids from the age of four, really. So how were they feeling as news of this was starting to filter through?
To be honest, I think whether you're a child or an adult, whether you're 10 or we've actually got some two-year-olds at Barlow Hall, I think we've all been a bit bewildered. Even as adults, we've been very bewildered. So you can imagine for children how difficult it's been. So, you know, on the last Friday, we brought everybody together. We did a bit of an assembly. We have a school song. So we sang the school song, and we promised that would be the first thing we would do when we were all back together. And just looking at the children's of the faces, you know, when I stood in front of the assembly, it was very, very strange. And normally you would expect children, when you say, you know, and we're finishing school, sometimes you'll get some round of applause or a bit of a cheer. It was absolutely, deathly silent. So, you know, we've just done our best, really, to try and alleviate the anxiety, both for the families that we work closely with. And the families have been brilliant. We've got flowers, we've got chocolates, we've got cards, and, you know, thanks for making the difference. And it was a great sort of team spirit, but it was strange. It was very strange.
And what are you doing to support pupils, their well-being, their education, while they're away from school, while most of them are at home?
So we've done a lot around education for the children. So, you know, but some of the barriers have been just simple things like making sure that email addresses for parents were up to date. That has been one of our biggest barriers. But we've set up, we call them our deluxe work packs. So we've set up the work packs. And by the end of Friday, we still had over 100 work packs left. So my staff have home delivered the work packs to families, sometimes because the families were self-isolating, sometimes because, you know, they weren't able to get to school. So we've delivered work packs. We are also daily emailing our families with, if you like, a bit of a plan for the day. And then we can refer to what is in the work pack, or sometimes we're putting links and learning platforms on there. And I think we're just getting better and better. So whenever I open my emails now, that the teachers and the staff are just putting on, you know, here's a great idea, send this to the children. We kind of plan for our community. We know our community, we know our families, we know our children, we know what they need. So, for example, the work packs that we've set up, we know which families have got access to stationery, scissors, and we know which haven't. You know, so it's about looking at providing according to, you know, where families are and what their needs are. The well-being is something else, obviously, you know, and it's a big part of us trying to support the children. But it's quite difficult when you're so remote and it's all a bit virtual.
Jane, just give us this picture of how many kids do you still have in school out of the 300 or so that that are your pupils?
Yeah, so we've got 308 on roll. On Friday night, which was a very, very difficult day for anybody in schools, whether you're leading schools or just in the school, Friday was a very difficult day, emotionally, as well as trying to set up. You were closing down a school and setting up a new provision. So on Friday, we allocated 36 places in our, we're calling it our childcare provision. And those places were for children. Some children had educational healthcare plans. Some we were vulnerable for different reasons. And then obviously we've got a group around key workers. By Monday, we had, out of the 36, we had 16 actually turned up. By about 10:30, four of those families had withdrawn their children. And we've settled into a routine of somewhere between 6 and 10 children accessing each day. And I think that's relatively local to where I am. That's fairly typical. But they are having an absolute ball in the provision. There's no doubt about it. And the sunshine helped this week.
So that's definitely true. Now, you've got 46% of your children on free school meals.
Yes.
How worried are you about the sort of differential provision? How much do you think you can make up for that, the differential home provision that, that children have?
I think it's difficult. I think it's one of the reasons why we have set up a daily register, so that each individual class teacher is connecting through email with children. Today, we have looked at that register to see which children are accessing and which aren't. We, myself and the deputy, Jen, have got a safeguarding strategic approach. It's a bit like school improvement on the hoof, really. But we really wanted to make sure. So we've kind of worked it in three different levels. We've obviously got our, if you like, our sort of high-end social work involvement, children on child protection planning. We've also then got our middle band of children that we know are going to struggle for food, you know, for all sorts of different reasons. And then we've also got a band that we've picked up today, children that are not accessing our emails, we're not hearing from. So my staff have been phoning to try and make sure that we've got a full picture. So this morning I was actually home visiting with Jen to try and connect with families that we'd not heard from.
That must be incredibly difficult, because you're sort of home visiting while not being able distancing. To, well, keeping your distance,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yes, we are keeping the distance. Yeah, we're you know,
on
we're,
the doorstep, yes, home visiting on the doorstep.
Yes, we are home visiting. Actually, we've been asked inside a lot. and then yeah. No one had to say, oh, we can't do that. So, you know, and actually the families are thrilled to see us. You know, they're really, you know, so that's good. That's been really nice.
And how do you get them to school, the middle group who are reliant on free school meals and who are obviously not getting them or haven't been getting them? What's the strategy there?
Free school meals, I mean, we've got a list. We have communicated. We've got different strategies. So for some of our families, we're delivering them. And then what we've tended to do is we've delivered sort of 2 or 3 days. So they've got a supply for 2 or 3 days. Other families are able to come in. They're seeing it as part of their daily walk. They're coming to school and collecting them. And then we're just, this is why we're home visiting as well, to make sure that that children have got access to food. And I don't know whether you know, Jeff and Ed, but in Manchester, there is an amazing facility for women called Emmeline's Pantry. It's a fantastic concept that families are accessing. They have we refer in, and they are able to collect 4 weeks' food, which has been an absolute godsend to these families. So that's been amazing. So we've connected with that as well.
It's a great irony, or not irony, but it's a sort of challenge here, isn't it? Because in a sense, I don't want to say this to a head teacher, but that well-being matters more than learning at this stage. Yeah. I suspect you'd agree with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you need to give kids things to do, and there'll be some kids who lap up the learning, partly because of their home environment, and some kids who don't.
Absolutely.
So it must be a really difficult sort of dilemma for you.
It is a dilemma because parents can sometimes, you kind of know the ones that will and you know the ones that won't, and the ones that won't really need it most. You know, what we're trying to do with the activities that we're giving our children is also about looking after their well-being. So that, you know, there's a lot of mindful activities, there's a lot of sport, exercise. So we're trying to get the whole balance around that well-being, and we planned our work packs and our activities to do that. So the learning and the well-being for me sometimes can be quite integral to each other as well. But my staff, as staff will be in all schools, you know, they will be so committed to making sure that, you know, that children feel that they're there for them, you know, so they, you know, some of the things that the children are sending are fabulous. So we're getting photographs, and we're getting a little bit of blogs, and you know, they're uploading writing that they're doing. So, you know, so there's lots of really, really good things that families are doing to support their children.
Can I ask you a more personal question, Jane, which I hope you don't mind me asking, which is how does a head teacher in your position cope yourself with the stress of this moment? Because, you know, this is not a sort of normal, in any sense, a normal set of challenges that you're facing.
No, I don't think it's normal challenges, but I think, you know, we're all in the same boat, really. So I think what you do is you just alleviate anxiety for children as much as you possibly can. As part of their activity today, Ed, we actually asked them some of your questions, so I might be able to read you out some of the things that they've shared
Definitely.
With us, really. So I'll read you a couple of things, really. I think the key words that have come out, the words that have been repeated, are things like strange, weird, sad, upset. The key thing is missing the friends. There's something about being sociable in a school. They're very keen to tell us how they're trying hard with their learning. But then they used words like lonely, worried. And they were asking how we were, which is lovely. I think there's a sense that they're missing out, that they feel like they're missing out. But then there were some great things, that they've loved the sunshine. They've loved being with their family. They've quite enjoyed learning with their family. They've learned to play drafts, things that they've not tried before. And they also recognise that they feel safe because they're staying at home. They do understand that concept, which I think was quite reassuring, really. But one of the things, so I'll just read out perhaps a typical example. The mum says that the child that has responded misses school terribly. Those were her words. But then the child has said that throughout the week I felt different emotions, but mainly I felt sad. I'm sad that I'm not in school, not seeing my friends and teachers and learning different things. But I also feel hope that things will change and go back to normal. I felt pride last night when I clapped for the carers and the NHS. It will be hard, but I feel we can all get through this. And I just thought that was such a lovely way of sort of, you know, great hope at the end, really. Yeah. So,
well, I think you've set us all off, Jane.
I was set off like 10 minutes ago when you were talking about the school song, and now I'm in bits.
Well, there's nothing that our children and most children are if they're not resilient, you know. And I think that, you know, they just need to know that they're safe and that we're here, and we will continue to be there. And I think that's what school staff know that they can do for children, because, you know, as the time goes on, they'll become more anxious and more isolated, and we just need to do more and more as weeks pass.
Jane, I must say, you know, we've done lots of interviews on this podcast, but it is incredibly humbling to talk to you. I mean, I think it's just extraordinary what you and others and so many teachers and head teachers like you are doing, and teaching assistants and support staff around the country. And I think we owe you an enormous debt of gratitude.
Well, I think we just need to keep our eye on what's happening. And people that are, you know, are frontline, and we've got to support them. That is very much, I think in schools we understand that, you know, we've got nurses that attend this school. You know, I've got a nursery boy here who is, both his parents are doctors. So, you know, we need to do our bit, really. So, you know, we'll continue to do that. And I know that that is shared by schools across the country, certainly in Manchester.
OK, Jane Kennedy, head teacher of Barlow Hall Primary School in Manchester, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to speak to you. Thank you.
To talk about the differential impact of this crisis on different families, we're now joined by Professor Becky Francis, who is Chief Executive of the Education Endowment Foundation, a charity working on breaking the link between family income and educational achievement. Becky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for welcoming me.
What do we know about the impact of school closures on children's education and the differential impact?
So we know that children learn less when they're not in school. There's actually a really extensive research literature looking at the impact of holidays, summer holidays particularly, on learning, as well as studies that explore the impact of pupil absence or enforced school closures, for example, due to extreme weather. Now, in some of those studies, there's a suggestion that there's, of course, learning loss over that period of time. And then you asked about, you know, the impact on different groups. And there's quite strong academic consensus that school closures have a stronger negative effect on disadvantaged children than on their peers. And there's a whole range of reasons for that, as you'd imagine. Disadvantaged young people are likely to be affected worse by school closures because they have fewer educational activities and resources at home, lower availability of books and so forth, and of course lower rates of parental involvement and understanding due to differentials in family education, or indeed due to working patterns, which is a real issue at the moment. And again, we know that different families will have different levels of access to digital provision. So, for example, whereas most households these days have, you know, a laptop or a computer and so forth, there's strong differentials between how many there are in each household. So whether all kids have access to that.
And tell us a little bit in broad terms what you think schools can be doing to limit the unequalizing effects of this period of school closure.
Yeah, so we think that there are two elements, really. So we know that the use of technology is, it's really hard to replace the learning relationships that exist between teachers and pupils in the classroom. And of course, the research says that that is what makes most difference to kids' progress and learning, and that that's particularly important for disadvantaged kids. So it's really important that there is high quality provision of digital and remote education for young people, and that where teachers can monitor that progress for disadvantaged pupils particularly, that will be really beneficial. There's also potential in offers like online tuition services and so forth, again, making sure that the quality's there and that that goes to the right pupils. But then we also think that it's going to be really important that schools are supported once they open up again to very quickly reboost young people's learning so that there's a good bounce back for these young people. And that can be done in a range of ways. We're actually looking at the possibility of, you know, what would the effect be to extend the pupil premium spending for policy at the moment, which, as you know, targets financial resource towards disadvantaged young people, and that there may be need for policy approaches like that once schools reopen.
And something we've not talked about yet is this matter of the calculated grades that are replacing cancelled exams. Is there any concern that these could disadvantage certain groups of pupils?
Yes, I think absolutely. So, of course, there's great uncertainty for all and the potential for unfairness for every individual child. The issue about the kind of late bloomer phenomenon is well documented and a risk for all groups. But there are particular risks for pupils from disadvantaged backgrounds. So, for example, research has shown that predicted grades are often inaccurate, and also that they often underpredict the performance of high-attaining disadvantaged students. You know, those sort of stereotypes and biases are hard to combat.
Can I ask a sort of heretical question maybe to end with, Becky, which is, this is obviously a terrible situation. Do you think that there will be lessons that we learn from what has happened which can inform the future of our education system? I mean, I'm thinking of, my son is not going to take his SATs at the age of 11 this year because, you know, the SATs have been cancelled. GCSEs are not going to happen. Are there lessons about the over-examination of children in this country which somehow might play out in some of the data that we see on children? Will it be not possible to tell? Or what's your thinking on that?
I think there are definitely going to be long-term effects on our system in a whole variety of different ways. I think that some of the issues about resource and about modes of delivery are going to be long lasting. So on the one hand, I think that once schools reopen, the value that society places both on teachers but also on those classroom relationships is going to be enormous. That being said, I think that the fact that we will have been through a period of months with only online delivery will mean that those digital modes of delivery won't stop. You know, schools will have got the hang of them, and therefore very rapid work and evidence provision on what is the most effective and high quality platforms will be really imperative to support the school sector, because we're in quite early days with that in this country.
I think, certainly speaking as a parent, I valued my kids' teachers already, but I think every parent will be thinking, you know, I realise firsthand what a difficult job they do.
Absolutely.
Becky Francis, Chief Executive of the Education Endowment Foundation, thanks so much for joining us, and do stay safe.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you think of that?
Well, I found talking to Dan incredibly useful from a personal point of view. And just hearing from Jane, I found it very moving. And, you know, I think sometimes we undervalue teachers in our society, or certainly take schools for granted. And I hope that when we come out the other side of this, that shifts a little bit, and I get the sense that it will.
Yeah, I mean, I must say I completely concur with what you say. I mean, I just found myself incredibly moved by what Jane was saying. I think the other thing that really occurs to me, well, I suppose two other things occur to me. One is, and Justine and I were discussing this, I think it's much, much more important for kids to be happy during this crisis than to learn. You know,
yeah.
Just because if you make them learn, but they're like unhappy, it's going to really have a sort of long-term effect of that horrible time for them. Well, I think if they're happy during, as happy as they can be during this crisis, then I think that's really important for their long-term kind of mental health. And I think it feels like Dan was confirming that. And then secondly, we're just obviously going to face big, big challenges of educational inequality, heightened challenges of educational inequality, which will be easy to forget about once the crisis is over, and we can't.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, in this very, very difficult time for the country and indeed the world, please do get in touch with us. We do want to hear from you about what you think you want to hear on this podcast. So you just need to go to cheerfulpodcast.com. Please do email us. We're flexible in the sense that we'll obviously do our weekly episode, but if the sort of need or the occasion arises, we might do extra shorter episodes as well. So if the things you want to hear about, cheerful stories that you think will cheer people up, because goodness knows we need them at this time, please do get in touch with us.
This comes from Hannah, who says, in these times of quarantine, I've often found myself going down Wikipedia rabbit holes, and I was wondering if Ed is aware there's a whole Wikipedia page dedicated to the bacon sandwich incident.
Did no, you know I wasn't this, Ed? Aware, actually, Hannah. Funnily enough, I hadn't searched for that.
She says it's remarkably detailed and made
excellent.
For a nice, light-hearted read that harked back to simpler times. My favourite quote from the whole article is this: Cameron's Conservatives won the general election with an unexpected overall majority. Following Labour's defeat, Miliband resigned as leader. It is unclear what effect, if any, the photograph had on the eventual result. She continues, if I were Ed, I'd personally feel very powerful knowing that my ability, or lack of, to eat a bacon sandwich could alter the course of democracy.
She also says, on a final note and a direct appeal to Jeff, in these times of quarantine, will you finally tell us the leisure centre story? Especially now all leisure centres are closed, you bring that leisure-related content that we're all sorely missing in our lives. Now, for those who don't remember this or weren't listening to the podcast, it was about 18 months ago now where Jeff was telling a rather long, convoluted, but yet nevertheless fascinating, but nevertheless, I want to emphasise this fascinating story about taking Jean to the leisure centre. And I then made some slightly sort of offhand remark about this story. And then Jeff, in a way that one's parents used to do with when one was a kid, said, well, I'm not going to tell you the end of the story now. And I've been, you know, desperately trying to persuade him to no avail, and I eventually gave up. Jeff, this is the moment till us the end of the life.
No,
come on.
It's not happening.
Man,
it's not happening.
Come on. It's what we need. We need leisure-related content.
There's too much pressure on the story. It's like when you're telling an anecdote at dinner and then the waiter comes over just before you get to the punchline and you can never recover from that moment. You have to abort and abandon the story. I'll tell you what, I will tell that story if you release the video of you on a trampoline and the video of the two of us in the hot tub in Iceland.
I mean, I'm almost tempted to say yes. I mean... You know,
but not quite.
Well, I'll take it under advisement. But I am, you know, I'm sort of think I might be there with the trampoline video,
but not the hot tub.
I think the hot tub. I'm not sure we want hot tub related content at this moment.
That's the deal breaker.
I think. Well, let's watch this space.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
So in the Cheerful People slot this week, we are joined by Alex and Amy to talk about the Cares family. Now, Alex, it's not your first time on the podcast. This is Alex Smith. He is the founder and CEO of the Cares family. Do you want to just remind people who are perhaps new listeners or just forgetful what the Cares family is?
Thanks for having me on, Jeff. Thanks, Ed. The Cares family is a group of community networks all over the country. So three in London, one in Manchester, one in Liverpool. And what they do is they bring older people in their 70s, 80s and 90s together to share time, laughter and new experiences with younger people, especially young professionals arriving in big cities. And we do that to reduce loneliness and isolation amongst older and younger people and also to bridge generational divides. So we've been doing that for about 9 years, but obviously we've had to suspend those programs in the last couple of weeks and find new ways of bringing older and younger people together.
And how have you done that? How have you adapted to the social distancing?
So I guess it's the people that we work with, especially the older people, are most at risk, both of COVID-19 and of social isolation. And that left us with a pretty difficult ethical or moral dilemma a couple of weeks ago when we were deciding how quickly we should be suspending our programs. So we had to communicate very quickly that we were doing that across thousands of people in the areas that we work in. But then very quickly, we refound the energy to try and reinvent all of our programs. So one of the programs that we normally run is called Social Clubs. They're normally, in normal times, dance parties, new technology, workshops, choirs, Desert Island Disc Nights, that sort of thing, where older and younger people share stories. And that has now all gone online. So we've piloted online social clubs, little dance parties, little group gatherings, and we hope to be able to expand those in the next few weeks. We have also got, and this is lovely, we've got lots and lots and lots of messages from younger people who have sent in poems, recipes, messages of hope, stories, quizzes, all of that sort of really creative content. And we've sent that to about 3,000 of the older people in our communities over the last week or so. And finally, we're trialling, although we may not be able to do this at scale because there are obvious kind of safeguarding and data questions around this, but we're trialling for the time being, getting people to deliver food and prescriptions for the people in our communities who most need those.
Amy, tell us about how you first got involved with North London Cares and how you're coping in this crisis.
Well, I first got involved in about 2017. It started off as a bit of a New Year's resolution. I just wanted to do something to kind of volunteer and help the community. But I'd also recently lost all of my grandparents. So I was kind of missing that connection with older people as well. So when my friend told me about North London Cares, I thought it was the perfect thing to get involved with. So I signed up and I have been going to the social clubs at least once a month, every month since then. Also done some fundraising by running the half marathon. It is really difficult during this time to cope. And that's me being a young person that lives with my boyfriend and got access to lots of technology. So I can, you know, reach out to all my family members. So it does make me really sad to think that some of our older neighbours that maybe don't have that technology set up in their homes or aren't maybe living with any of their friends or family, you know, they might be struggling during this time.
And you've written a poem for the older people you're not currently able to see. Tell us what inspired you to do that.
Well, we got an email sent round from one of the social club's organisers a few weeks ago saying that they'd had to make the decision to suspend all the social clubs, which is obviously a sensible decision, but very sad because it completely goes against the whole thing that North London Cares is trying to do. But they did say, if you've got anything that you want to send us while we're trying to work out how to navigate through this crisis, then please do. So I just thought I'd send a poem which had some ideas of things that our older neighbours could do at home, watching a film or writing a short story, and then maybe we can meet up and discuss those and share those with each other when we do actually see each other again at the social clubs.
Will you give us a little reading?
So, hello to all my neighbours that I won't see for a little while. I thought I'd send a short poem that will hopefully make some of you smile. Life might get a bit boring while we're being told to quarantine and repeatedly singing happy birthday to keep hygienic and clean. So keep yourselves entertained and know that I'm thinking of you. Why don't you put on your own film club, maybe have a cuppa or two? You could do some creative writing, record a podcast on your phone, read a book or do some painting. There's loads you can do at home. And when we reunite, I'll look forward to hearing what you've done. We'll be back at the clubs in no time, having lots of laughter and fun.
That is a lovely poem. I was going to end on this question, Alex, which is, do you think that there's a chance that this crisis will end up linking people better with their neighbours, you know, the people on their street who are elderly and vulnerable? I mean, it feels like some of that is happening, not just from the outpouring of national volunteers, but from what's happening in localities all around the country.
Yeah, and I think fear is temporary, but hope is permanent. And so I definitely have the hope and have seen already so many amazing community organisations, organic projects, you know, the amazing mutual aid projects that are coming up. There is a sense that our lives are intertwined. This is demonstrating what that means. It's more than just abstract now. I think people can see that our health is intertwined with one another's and our opportunity is intertwined with one another's. And I really think and I hope that, you know, this is the low point almost, or the most difficult moment of decades of economic pressure, inequality, a lack of connection and a lack of community that leads to an uptick in all of those things. And there are signs already that we can people want to create a more sustainable world and a world where people know one another and are looking out for one another. And that's one of the things that I'm really hopeful comes out of this moment.
Well, to both of you, there's obviously lots of ways people can volunteer, including the National Volunteer Scheme, and hundreds of thousands of people have volunteered for that. But Alex, in particular, if people want to get involved in the Cares family during this period, there'll be people at home who maybe haven't heard of the Cares family before, but who want to do their bit for people in their community. Tell us how and where people can volunteer.
Two ways, really. The first is visit www.thecaresfamily.org.uk, and from there you'll be directed to a local branch of the Cares family if there is one in your area. And the second way that you can help is, obviously, there are lots of charities going through very difficult times financially right now. We're running a crowdfunder, which is matched by one of our generous supporters. So £10 that you may be able to donate becomes £20, and so on. So if people are able to give a little bit at this time to help their elders to stay connected in what is a really disconnecting time, then we'd obviously really appreciate that.
OK, Alex Smith and Amy Harvey, thank you very much for what you're doing during this crisis. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro. I wanted to raise something, which is I've been doing quite a lot of work online, including online calls through mainly through Zoom. I mean, I think there's just a whole new world that we're sort of being educated into. And I sort of feel like somebody now in my 50s that it's quite challenging. But also there's sort of no... You're entering a world of etiquette that you didn't know existed. You know, should you be in vision?
Yeah, because we haven't been in vision at all on the podcast, apart from at one stage when we weren't recording, you wanted to show me your hair, that it's getting long,
yeah.
And your concerns around that. But, I mean, is it okay to sit here in your pyjamas, for example?
I think being out of vision is better if you can sort of, if you can get that as the sort of default mode, actually.
Mm.
I mean, don't you think? Because I think when I was a child, people used to talk about video calls and what are they going to be like, and it was very much tomorrow's worldy video calls. You know, it's like, what if you're on the loo? You know, and
they'd never know when it's audio only.
Well, I mean, not if you're on mute. I mean, I think both mute and turning off the camera seem to me to be really quite important features. Right. I'd like to thank our guests, Jeff, Jane Kennedy, who I thought was absolutely brilliant, Dan O'Hare, who's obviously doing incredibly important work, as is Becky Francis.
And thanks to Alex and Amy for telling us what's going on with the Cares family. Emma Caution produces our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon.
And Teresa Regan, Joel's mother, who recommended Jane Kennedy as our guest.
What a great suggestion, Teresa. We salute you. Thank you. And thank you for raising such a fine young man.
Yeah.
Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the Idents Ed Seed, composed the music, and our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole. He's been Jeff Lloyd.
He's been Ed Miliband.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.